to take place on the mechanism, frameworks and criteria involved in order to reach a framework for an agreement.
Bogheri said the sides are set to discuss banking and financial sanctions in the coming days. Meanwhile, EU coordinator Enrique Mora says the talks need to end within a reasonable period of time, which, according to him, should be a matter of weeks rather than months. Mora said difficult political decisions need to be made, both in Tehran and Washington. Iran says if the other side shows it's ready to effectively remove sanctions and give the necessary guarantees, the talks can conclude successfully. Talks will continue at the level of experts and deputy foreign ministers in the coming days as efforts intensify to make the challenging prospect of a restored JCPOA a reality. Homolezki, Vienna.
A meeting was held here in Western Kabul to bring the Islamic Emirate and the people closer together. The meeting was organized by a Shia association to pave the way for national solidarity in Afghanistan. During the meeting, the religious leaders and the Taliban officials stressed the need for mutual trust between people and the government.
One of the main responsibilities of the ruling group is nation building. Afghan nation is mainly composed of our Shia and Sunni brothers. We are part of United Ummah of Islam. In order to have a united Afghanistan, we should trust each other and rely on mutual values. The new government needs to represent all sections and ethnicities of Afghanistan.
Conspiracy is one of US and the Soviet Union's main heritages in our country. They destroyed the soil with it. The Islamic Emirate need to find a way for creating unity in Afghanistan. We are all Muslims, and we believe in God. Anyone who lives in Afghanistan is entitled to live in peace and play the role in the reconstruction of the country.
The religious leaders warn against foreign interference in Afghanistan and stress the urgency to get united.
The only thing that our country needs is peace and unity. We should build trust and get united. We must distinguish between our friends and enemies.
After taking power in August, the Taliban leaders have repeatedly held talks with the Shia community, seeking their support and allegiance. Shia Afghans support an Islamic government, but believe it must be an inclusive one. They want to see people in power who make Afghanistan a safe place for all. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the role and position of family. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the role and position of family in the Islamic lifestyle. The role and the position of family in our life is that the family is a place of peace and family is a place of nurturing and training. Therefore, if we have a good family, if we have good people in our family, if the members of the family are ethically good, socially good, they are well educated, therefore we can see that such families are the place of peace. On top of that, if the family members have the fear of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, if they are just, if they are against oppression, we can see within the family there is a peace. Within the family, because everyone is connected to God, they have relations with each other because of God, according to the teachings of the Quran, where Quran says, "Walil walidaini ihsana," do good to your parents. Where Quran and the narration says that train your kids in the best way, have mercy upon your kids, have mercy upon the elder ones. So when we look at the family, if there are grandparents, if there are parents, if there are children or grandchildren, there is a peaceful environment within the family. And this is what Islam wants, that Islam talks about peace, and it wants this peace to start from the family, from within the family, and spread in the society, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the role and position of the family, and we said Islam wants the family to be a place of peace so that it can have peace within it and then spread it to the society and become a role model for the others. Therefore, we can see there are many families, for example, the family of Imam Ali alayhi salam and Hazrat Fatima Zahra salamu alayha with their children, Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein, and Hazrat Zainab, Hazrat Kulsoom. So we can see a lovely family who lived in a peaceful environment. And on top of that, there is another prophecy of family, which is nurturing and training. If the parents are trained and nurtured wellly, then they can train or nurture their kids in the same way. Therefore, it is the duty of the family and not the teachers in the school. It is the duty of family and not someone outside there. It is the responsibility of the family and not the maulana or the scholar at the mosque or imam at the mosque to nurture or train kids. The basic training starts from the family. If within family, people take care of what they do, for their actions, for the way they talk, for the way they deal with the others, if they are concerned about the wajibat, which are necessary deeds, if they take care of forbidden things, then obviously in such a family, when a child is being nurtured or trained, he will be trained according to the Islamic teachings. Therefore, in Islamic lifestyle, it is very important to have a good family or to develop an Islamic family, inshallah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/en Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight.
Report says countries must strengthen climate ambitions after wasting chance to build back better after COVID-19 pandemic. We now present you an article written by Fiona Harvey. The piece is titled, UN Warns World Faces Disastrous 2.7 Degrees Celsius Temperature Rise on Current Climate Plans. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. According to a report from the United Nations, the world is squandering the opportunity to build back better from the COVID-19 pandemic and faces disastrous temperature rises of at least 2.7 degrees Celsius if countries fail to strengthen their climate pledges. On Tuesday, 26th of October, The report was published warning that countries' current pledges would reduce carbon by only about 7.5% by 2030, far less than the 45% cut scientists say is needed to limit global temperature rises to 1.5 degrees Celsius. The aim of the COP26 summit that opens in Glasgow, Scotland, this Sunday, 31st of October. Antonio Guterres, the United Nations Secretary General, described the findings as a thundering wake-up call to world leaders, while experts called for drastic action against fossil fuel companies. According to the United Nations Emissions Report, which examines the shortfall between countries' intentions and actions needed on the climate, although more than 100 countries have promised to reach net zero emissions around mid-century, this would not be enough to stave off climate disaster. Many of the net zero pledges were found to be vague, and unless accompanied by stringent cuts in emissions this decade, would allow global heating of a potentially catastrophic extent. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres said, "The heat is on, and as the contents of this report show, the leadership we need is off, far off. Countries are squandering a massive opportunity to invest COVID-19 fiscal and recovery resources in sustainable, cost-saving, planet-saving ways." As world leaders prepare for the COP26 conference in Glasgow, this report is another thundering wake-up call. How many do we need? Inge Andersen, the Executive Director of the United Nations Environment Programme, UNEP, which produced the report, said, "Climate change is no longer a future problem. It is a now problem. To stand a chance of limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius, we have 8 years to almost halve greenhouse gas emissions. 8 years to make the plans, put in place the policies, implement them, and ultimately deliver the cuts. The clock is ticking loudly." The United Nations report found emissions fell by about 5.4% last year during COVID lockdowns, but only about a fifth of the spending on economic recovery was geared to efforts that would cut carbon. The United Nations said this failure to build back better, despite promises by governments around the world, cast doubt on the world's willingness to make the economic shift necessary to tackle the climate crisis. In the run-up to COP26, countries were supposed to submit national plans on emission cuts, called Nationally Determined Contributions, or NDCs, for the next decade, a requirement under the 2015 Paris Climate Accord. But the United Nations Environment Programme report found only half of countries had submitted new NDCs, or Nationally Determined Contributions, with big emitters still to publish their plans, and several governments, including Brazil, Australia and Mexico, had presented weak plans that were no improvement on their 2015 Paris pledges. Joanna Depledge of the Cambridge Centre for Environment, Energy and Natural Resource Governance said, "The picture painted by the report is grim. Less than half of the nationally determined contributions, or NDCs, are genuinely more ambitious than the first round submitted in 2015 or 2016. Joanna Depledge added, "There is an ambition gap between country pledges and the cuts needed to limit temperature rise. And even more troubling is an implementation gap. Many large emitters are not even on track to meet their existing pledges." According to the report, which took into account pledges made before the end of September, longer-term net-zero pledges for mid-century have now been adopted by 49 countries as well as the European Union, putting about half of global emissions, half of GDP, and about a third of the global population under net zero pledges. But Inga Anderson says net zero promises from governments were often vague or ambiguous. She said if these could be made robust and implemented fully, the world could have 0.5 degrees Celsius off the projected warming of 2.5 degrees Celsius that the United Nations Environment Programme has predicted. Yoeri Rogel, the Director of Research at Grantham Institute, Imperial College London, says if implemented, current net zero targets would lower temperature projections for the next century by about 0.5 degrees Celsius, bringing central estimates close to 2 degrees Celsius, yet still not in line with holding global warming well below 2 degrees Celsius, let alone 1.5 degrees Celsius. Yoeri Rogel says, on the other hand, the report also highlights that in many cases, countries' near-term targets are not yet putting emissions a clear track towards achieving their net zero goals. This casts doubt on whether these targets will ever be achieved. Ed Miliband, Britain's Shadow Business Secretary, says it's time for the government to start telling the truth about how far away we are from where we need to be in this decisive decade. This report makes clear there can be no shifting of the goalposts from action this decade to targets in the middle of this century. If we follow this course, we will fail to keep global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius and betray future generations. Ed Miliband added, "The window of action is closing, and it is critical that in the budget and the days ahead, the Prime Minister and the government step up to make COP26 the summit of climate delivery, not climate delay." The emissions gap report also highlighted methane, a powerful greenhouse gas that arises from animal husbandry, natural gas extraction and waste. The United States and the European Union and more than 20 other countries have signed a pledge to reduce methane emissions globally by 30% this decade. The United Nations Environment Programme says methane was the second biggest contributor to temperature rises after carbon, and that about 20% of annual methane emissions could be cut at little or no cost, for instance through better management of natural gas drilling, stopping flaring and capping old wells. Miles Allen, a professor of geosystems science at University of Oxford in England, has championed the idea of forcing fossil fuel companies and other big emitters to pay for the permanent storage of the carbon they emit through a carbon take-back obligation using carbon capture and storage technology. Miles Allen said, "On current progress, we'll close the 2030 emissions gap sometime in the 2080s. There is no appetite for reducing fossil fuel consumption globally at the rate required. The only remaining option is to scale up safe and permanent disposal of carbon dioxide, such as storing it back underground instead of fly-tipping it into the atmosphere." Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We will be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism. This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. Please stay tuned.
عزیزان من، برادران، خواهران، خطرناکترین نوع خرافات
The most harmful and dangerous type of superstition is the religious one. This means that a religion, namely Islam or Christianity, is mixed with the beliefs or thoughts which have no roots in divinity and are man-made. Sometimes the belief system of a religion is threatened by superstitions. We can find many examples in the sermons or ceremonies that are held for Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. In other words, sometimes the personal opinions and ideas of people interfered in the religious system and make it weak or baseless.
خدا رحمت کنه مرحوم آیت الله عظمی مرعشی اعلی الله مقامه الشریف تو این کتاب.
The late Ayatollah Mar'ashi Najafi was among the ulama who criticized superstitious beliefs very much. In his opinion, one of the most superstitious sects in Islam is Sufism. As he clearly stated in his book, Ihqaq al-Haq, I believe Sufism is the biggest calamity in the world of Islam. The main reason to criticize such movements is the personal bias and preference on which their belief system is based. In fact, the unlawful rituals and behaviors can be seen vividly in some of the sects of Sufism. True Islam is based on the Quran and the teachings of the Prophet and Ahlul Bayt. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. To find out more about this program, log on to our website www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
A new face was put to Iran after its June the 18th presidential elections. The results were anticipated in 2019 and materialized in 2021. Participation was under 50%, but over 61% of ballots were cast in Ayatollah Raisi's name. Now, with every new president come new dilemmas, decisions, and results. These we'll be covering in Iran Today's year-ender episode today with me, Leila Faramarzi, so do stay tuned. Ebrahim Raisi inherited an important agenda, which is the Vienna talks for sanctions removal of Iran, and a big crisis, which is the corona pandemic with its many names and strains. Also, Iran's media and IT apparatus is blocked every so often. Now, to take a look at the elections that passed and the three issues Iran faces, stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, for the next 25 minutes or so. Iran's elections were the subject of much talk, as they generally have been for the past decade. Some Iranians had said they were not 100% sure they would participate in the elections at all because they were suffering an unjustified economic hardship. For this, I had a chat with Mr. Mohammad Reza Shojaian of Jama Jam Daily for a media man's take on election results.
There has been a gray spectrum. People who said they were not going to vote, but at the last moment went to the ballots. What I'm saying is that it could be regarded as a component of democracy in the country, because we have a wide range of different thoughts and ideologies in the country. Since our nation isn't ruled by a totalitarian system, as some falsely advertise against the Islamic Republic of Iran, people have the right to vote. We have been given this right. No one went to the ballots at knife point. We must pay attention to that.
Question is, basically, how did Raisi get to win? This I put to Mr. Naghavi, a former MP whom we always interviewed as an articulate political analyst. He received us at his electoral station from where he'd been campaigning to encourage voter participation.
Mr. Raisi was distinct among the seven presidential candidates. One can say that he had a clear advantage over the group. That's because the two reformist candidates, Mr. Meralizadeh and Hemmati, weren't even endorsed by the reformists. This caused them not to have any motivation to engage in the competition or go to the polls. Or, for example, Mr. Hemmati was considered a low-tier candidate of the executives of Construction Party. Among the principalists, also Mr. Ghazizadeh, Zakani and Jalili were closer to a possible presidency. But Mr. Raisi was head and shoulders above them in terms of his experience and background.
The 13th presidential election was held simultaneously with the 6th city and village council elections, midterm elections for the 5th assembly of experts, and midterm elections for the 11th parliament. City and village council elections were held with electronic ballot boxes in the capitals of 24 provinces, but not in Tehran.
The simple fact is that we didn't have the excitement we witnessed in the elections of 2017, 2013, 2005 or 1997. The excitement in those elections was tremendous. The turnout was over 70-80%, but this was a good election in its own right. About 48% of the eligible voters participated, which isn't unacceptable compared to other democratic systems. Although the elections are always filled with excitement and have 70-80% turnouts, 48% isn't too satisfactory for our people. But it's a good figure compared to other democratic systems.
Mr. Raisi said he wanted to be leader to the whole nation, left or right, young or old, while fighting the economic corruptions. I asked how realistic his presidential mottos had been.
You know, he spent all his life fighting corruption. He was a judge for many, many years. And that was the main theme of his election campaign. So he would want to do some of the promises that he made. And this is going to be something that he would be interested in engaging in. You know, they come, these clerics like him, come from that liberation theology school of thought that started the Islamic Revolution. Clerics that believe they have a role in society, they need to take care of the poor, they need to have social programs.
The past 3 years have been an unmatched time in Iranian politics. A principalist atmosphere started taking over the Iranian political sphere. Although Mr. Raisi ran for president as an independent, he was appointed chief of judiciary as a principalist in 2019. Next, the legislature or parliament's majority was won by principalists in 2020. And the same Mr. Raisi moved to the executive in 2021. The judiciary is also headed by a well-known principalist figure, Ghulam Hossein Ejei, although the judiciary is generally principalist. Now, when it comes to national interest-related decisions on whether to compromise or not to compromise, methods and people may change, but the goals and framework remain intact. Political senior figures in this country tend to agree on this, and President Raisi pledged to get sanctions lifted off this country, just as he pledged to improve relations with neighbors. Raisi, being a principalist, he's been expected to take a harder stance in determining U.S. good faith and actual sanctions relief. The JCPOA-related sanctions removal Vienna talks began in April, and they are still ongoing with short intervals every now and then.
Addressing the Supreme Council of the Ministry of Defense of the Russian Federation, Russian President Vladimir Putin made some very practical and important remarks. He said the Americans easily withdraw from any deal without providing any explanation, answer or reasoning for their moves. To quote Mr. Putin, he said, "That's why we demand legally binding commitments and guarantees from the US that the current expansion of NATO along our eastern borders does not continue." So, when the Russian president believes that the US is not committed to any deal and easily exits them, it shows that the Islamic Republic of Iran is taking the correct stance.
The United States began passing laws in breach of the JCPOA right after its signing. May the 8th, 2018 is the day Donald Trump binned the deal and accused Iran of lying about its commitments. Just the following day, the international nuclear watchdog chief noted again that Iran is meeting the terms of the agreement. Even the then U.S. Secretary of State himself, Mike Pompeo, admitted that there was no evidence Iran was in violation of the agreement. It bears the conclusion there was no legitimate basis for Trump to pull out and reimpose sanctions on this country.
As a member of the International Atomic Energy Agency, we volunteered to sign a safeguard deal with the IAEA. All our nuclear activities have been peaceful and we've done our utmost to cooperate on the issue so we can secure our legal rights. We don't allow the other side to make excessive demands. During the course of the talks, the Islamic Republic's proposals to the Western side have convinced the other P4 plus 1 negotiators that Iran will not give up its rights.
Thing is, Iran signed the 2015 nuclear deal or JCPOA with six world powers to get UN economic-related sanctions lifted off this country to boost its economy and oil sales. In return, Iran was to limit its nuclear program. This it did. But former U.S. President Donald Trump still unilaterally, and most would say illegally, pulled out of the JCPOA and reimposed and reinforced the sanctions on Iran, now as U.S. sanctions. Iran even waited a year for Europeans to execute a way around what was now U.S. sanctions, but to no avail.
The insistence of Iran's new negotiating team and the talks that have been held has made other teams align their positions with Iran. Over 80% of the proposals the Iranian side has put forward has been or have been taken into consideration despite the sabotage attempts from the three European signatories, especially France. Iran's demands have lifted those pressures and now the outlook looks promising. God willing, the course of the deal will end in a result that will serve the Iranian nation's interests.
Why would you say the Vienna talks and sanctions removal have taken so long, apart from the factors you said?
The talks have taken this long because we've been making preparations. There have been changes in the course of the negotiations. The European side has realized that if pressure mounts on the Islamic Republic, it will strengthen its regional agenda. Iran has ramped up uranium enrichment within the framework of the Parliament's resolution and the safeguard agreements it has with the IAEA. If Europe applies any pressure, Iran will continue doing that. That's why they've started giving concessions so that, God willing, a good deal that will be in our national interest will be reached.
Iran started to partially reduce its commitments to the JCPOA in 2019 in accordance with paragraph 36 of the multilateral agreement. Paragraph 36 allows one side to stop complying with the deal if the other side is out of compliance. If sanctions are lifted, Iran will immediately reverse its decisions and enhancing its nuclear program.
The claim that some political camps wanted to declare themselves the winners is totally false and entirely for journalistic effects. The fact that we've been able to win concessions from the Western side is because our diplomacy is becoming balanced. The previous administration's diplomacy excessively considered the West. We weren't using the opportunities our neighbors provided us. But as you see, in the 115 days since the 13th administration in Iran has taken office, Iran's diplomacy has changed based on the principles of dignity, wisdom, and expediency and took Iran out of the path towards isolation.
Looking at things as they are, Iran has actually gained strategic depth in deepening its partnership with Russia and China. It is neither exactly possible now to isolate Iran nor prudent to exercise the military option against it.
Our strategic allies such as the Russian Federation and China are actively supporting Iran. Over the past 2 weeks, the Russian Foreign Ministry has officially stated that the U.S. must provide guarantees and compensation to Iran. This convergence and the atmosphere of coalition building that Iran has created will lead the United States to change its game. Sometimes the Americans who created Israel and are behind all these incidents prefer balanced measures because the Islamic Republic has warned that in case the agreement falls apart, any adventurous measures or threat against Iran will threaten the entirety of U.S. interests.
Thus far, Israel has been provoking Western parties to the JCPOA, winning points for itself to put Iran behind. Now, do you think this is going to continue, looking at how the talks are going so far?
Certainly Israel will not abandon its hostility to Iran and will use any means to upset the balance in the region. But the regime and those who will aid it will be defeated. The situation is becoming such that it's Israel that's being isolated. The warmongering that Israel is advocating both in the political sense with the JCPOA and the security threats and destructive actions is taken and continues to take will backfire. Israel has never been and won't ever be a force to threaten Iran. The actions it's taken have all been merely to cause annoyance.
Time for a short break. We'll be back in no time.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
In the year that passed, that's 2021, like previous years, Iran suffered instances of Western media tyranny time and again. The most notable instance being the seizure of PressTV's.com domain. Several resistance-related media websites suffered the same. And recently, the UK imposed a ban on an Iranian journalist, a reporter, on claims of human rights violations. The British government accused Ali Rezvani, who is an Iranian state media journalist for the popular and highly watched 2030 news program, of being involved in the interrogation of detainees and broadcasting their forced confessions, as well as spreading misinformation regarding political prisoners, dissidents, and hostages. In reaction to the move by the British government, IRIB head Peyman Jebelli commended Rezvani's media valour and said the illegal measure was indicative of the British monarchy's political idiocy. I express my felicitations to you on your media effort and valour that has made the arrogant British government angry and confused, Jebelli said in a statement. The imposition of sanctions on a journalist by a monarchy whose record over the past centuries has been riddled with human rights abuses means that it has morphed into a political idiot much more than what was previously thought. The allegations against the Iranian reporter come against the dismal backdrop by the British government to muzzle free speech and disregard for the rights of minorities, as well as helping totalitarian governments in other countries to suppress their people. In October 2018, the results of the report by the Equality and Human Rights Commission, EHRC, showed that around 14 million Britons with disabilities, roughly a fifth of the UK population that is, have suffered from erosion of their rights. The study, which reported its findings to the United Nations Committee on Disability Rights, said that there was deeply concerning evidence showing that the situation of the disabled people across the UK is getting worse, despite government pledges to improve their conditions. A report released last October by the British NGO Action on Armed Violence, AOAV, showed that the British government has approved tear gas exports to numerous authoritarian West Asian regimes, including in the UAE, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Bahrain, over the past decade. The report went on, saying that since 2018, the British government has approved arms export licenses to 70 countries. Although several of these countries are on its own human rights priority list. And on the .com domain seizure, PressTV.com was not the only target. More than 30 outlets with links to the anti-Israel resistance movement were shut down. Although country domains aren't easy to block, as that will arouse international objection to undermining countries' sovereignty, so the US's act will have been a wasted effort. Iran simply continued its work on its .ir domain. During past years, Google, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and Instagram, all under the heavy influence of the US's antagonist approach towards Iran, have many times shut down or limited Iranian media access to their websites and services. But they have never been able to hamper or silence the voice speaking the truth. As the world is arriving upon a two-year mark for the global COVID-19 crisis, the new strain of COVID, Omicron, is spreading rapidly, much to the alarm of researchers worldwide. And that's just as the world was getting complacent with a vaccination program globally well underway for older strains of the disease. Omicron aside, even vaccination underway is not vaccination enough. For instance, inadequate vaccination distribution is still a major international problem, while vaccine hesitancy has been increasingly surfacing in different parts of the world. And there's a lack of consensus as to whether ready vaccines will do any good in the face of the new strain Omicron anyway. Iran faces a twin challenge in this regard. It's the public health emergency plus a sanctions-stricken economy. Iran says the number of people carrying the highly infectious Omicron variant of the coronavirus is increasing. Public relations manager of the Iranian Health Ministry, Mohammad Hashemi, did confirm 14 people in Iran were infected with Omicron. The first case here was confirmed on December the 25th. About 1,800 suspected cases were sent to laboratories for further tests days ago. Kamal Haydari, the deputy health minister, reportedly said, "We went to the health ministry where its educational center chief Dr. Rezai explained before the interview how it's imperative to prevent virus transmission best we can, cause it's by going from body to body that the virus recognizes human physiology and mutates into more dangerous strains that can infect everyone."
"Depending on which country foreign travelers are coming from, we ask for a negative COVID-19 test or a vaccine certificate. Arrivals from designated red countries are banned, like South Africa, where a new variant has emerged. Arrivals from such countries are banned except for special cases. For example, an Iranian national who's working there and is coming back is regarded as a special case. But they are treated differently from arrivals from other nations."
Even with the twin challenge Corona plus sanctions, Iran has a big advantage. That is, it has one of the best medical and public health infrastructures in West Asia, exporting its cadre of physicians abroad for decades. However, despite frontline health workers' heroic efforts to save lives, it may be many months before the coronavirus is best contained. It is feared the impact could be far-reaching. In the first year of the crisis, more than 1 million Iranians lost their jobs, as reported by Iran's Islamic Parliament Research Center. The government's reluctant imposed lockdowns have also severely affected the economy, which was already struggling due to US-led imposed economic sanctions, the fall in oil prices, corruption, and mismanagement. Iranian authorities had previously faced criticism over the slow pace of imports of vaccines, but tens of millions of doses have been imported in past months, the vast majority of which were China's Sinopharm along with AstraZeneca jabs.
We have vaccines in sufficient quantities and beyond the need for injection in our storage rooms. Some are still reluctant to receive their doses, but we hope we can overcome this challenge so the nationwide vaccination campaign can be completed. We plan to roll out booster shots by domestically made vaccines, considering the knowledge-based companies' work in producing them.
Studies show that people who are not vaccinated are 4.5 times more likely to develop COVID-19 than those who are fully vaccinated, and 10 and 11 times more likely to be hospitalized and die, respectively.
The unvaccinated account for some 85% of the death toll. This proves the effectiveness of the vaccines. The move the government made, despite all the sanctions and economic situation, to produce the medicine partly from imports and partly from inside Iran, as earlier planned in a national vaccine document, was indeed a valuable and laudable one. This was one of the health ministry's greatest achievements. Under that document, vaccinations started by prioritizing frontline health staff and high-risk people and then were accelerated and expanded to other people, so much so that now we have enough vaccines to inoculate the whole population, and thankfully we don't have any problems in that regard.
Iran's health ministry proposed a smart management platform that would keep restrictions in place only for those who were not vaccinated and did not adhere to necessary health protocols. Officials had said at the time that activities could go back to normal if service providers, service receivers, and venues would all follow protocols closely. Vaccination was said not to be mandatory for the general population. Schools reopened in late September, with most classes being conducted remotely online. Officials finally allowed students back into schools as part of a multi-step plan. Students aged between 12 and 18 were called up to receive jabs this autumn, without vaccination being mandatory. On vaccinations, Raisi vowed that his administration would continue to support domestic vaccine production, although he said no efforts would be spared to receive abundant supplies from abroad. In that light, Iran signed contracts with international manufacturers and expected about 100 million doses of coronavirus vaccines to be imported by the end of 2021. The COVAX facility pledged to provide Iran with 16.8 million doses of the vaccine. That's almost 17 million.
According to the health ministry, all vaccines can be used as booster shots for those injected initially. Therefore, all vaccines that are on the way will be used as booster shots. So the vaccine producers can't complain they were left out because the products came out later. We saw that the immunity in people over 60 decreases in about 4 to 6 months after getting fully vaccinated, exposing them to risk of infection. We have to continue to build up our domestic vaccine reserves. We'll be needing at least somewhere between 20 to 30 million doses as early as mid-March.
Iran's corona-infected cases to date have been under 6,200,000. That's next to under 280,400,000 cases globally. Deaths from the disease have been put at under 131,500, next to the global fatality of under 5,500,000 cases. As for recoveries, the figure is at over 6 million, next to under 250,400,000 globally. That's as of Monday morning, December the 27th, 2021. That'll be it for today and this year. Thanks for being with us all this time. Do return to the box at the same times next week and each week after. Till 2022, I bid you farewell, and from the whole team, a healthy, even happy new year.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hussain Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Shirazo. Today on The Key, we want to examine a question that might pop up in the minds of some people. And that question is regarding the reprehensibility of certain professions. There's a tradition narrated from the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wasallam regarding the reprehensibility of five professions. A certain man comes to the Holy Prophet and asked him regarding the profession he should encourage his son to pursue. The Prophet then mentions five professions which he discourages the person from allowing his son to pursue. One of them is the profession of a butcher. The other is that of a person who sells slaves. The third is the profession of a person who sells wheat. The fourth is the profession of a person who is a goldsmith. And finally, there's the profession of the person who sells burial shrouds for dead people. Now, we know that every profession which performs a function in society which is necessary for that society to continue is good, it could be recommended, and in certain cases it could be obligatory. Why then would the Prophet discourage this person from allowing his son or encouraging his son to pursue these professions? This is the question that we want to address here today. The answer to this question can be understood when we make an examination of the context within which this tradition has been related, and which the Prophet made this statement. In this tradition, the Prophet not only mentions these five professions and discourages this person from encouraging his son to pursue them, he also mentions the reason why that these professions should not be pursued. For example, the Prophet says that the person who sells burial shrouds, he wishes that people would die so that his business would thrive. Or that the person who is a butcher, by killing animals constantly, the person's heart becomes hardened. Or the person who sells wheat, he hoards the wheat so that the price of wheat would go up and he could sell it at exorbitant prices to the people so that his business can thrive. Or that the person who sells gold and is a goldsmith, he often cheats people when he weighs the gold. So by mentioning these reasons for the reprehensibility of these professions, we could easily say that their other professions are similar. I mean, if there's a profession that leads to these same problems, well, they would also be the same. This doesn't mean that there's something essentially wrong with these professions. Rather, if these professions lead to these unethical traits being created within the person, then they become, you know, frowned upon. They should not be discouraged. Otherwise, if a person can do something that would prevent these evil traits and unethical qualities from being created within him, then there's no reason why the person couldn't pursue these professions. Or if other professions also lead to the same traits, there's no reason why those professions would also be things which should not be pursued. Right? So this is not something that in this tradition doesn't indicate the essential incorrectness or reprehensibility of these professions. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the reprehensibility of certain professions in the eyes of Islam. Until next time, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir. IRIB English Radio.